program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site in the sound broadcasting. Our first article will be from our new March issue of Texas Monthly, and it'll be part of the state. This is News and Politics. It's a dispatch by Christopher Hooks, and this month's column is entitled Lena Hidalgo's Year of Living Dangerously. Led by a 20-something Latina, Democrats now run Harris County, offering a glimpse at what things might look like for better or for worse if the party finds itself back on top across Texas. Harris County Commissioner Steve Raddick leaned into his mic and grinned. It was May of 2016, and the longtime Republican commissioner for Precinct 3 had a fly he wanted to swat. His target was Democratic State Senator Rodney Ellis, who had recently announced his intention to run for Precinct 1, the only seat on a five-member commissioner's court that could be counted on to elect a Democrat. Ellis had endorsed, in righteous language, a federal lawsuit against the county by activists who hoped to radically reform Harris County's bail system. Raddick read aloud portions of a statement in which Ellis, who is African-American, condemned Harris County's, quote, over-reliance on the inefficient and ineffective use of mass incarceration, unquote, which he said had a particularly devastating effect on communities of color and the poor, and it resulted in some of the highest jailing and incarceration rates in the nation. Raddick waved a paper in the air, proving, he said, that many smaller Texas counties had higher incarceration rates. I think it's time Mr. Ellis either shut up or state the right facts, he said, smiling. It's kind of trash talking that's easier to engage when the target isn't in the room. For many years, Harris County Commissioner's Court, which oversees the third most populous county in the country and one of its most diverse, had been a place of easy consensus. At the time of Raddick's outburst, four of the five members of the Commissioner's Court were white Republican men. They included County Judge Ed Emmett, a popular moderate in a party running out of them. Most sessions passed by with the placidity of a koi pond. By cheering activists who sued the county and asserting that commissioners were supporting a racist policy while simultaneously trying to join their ranks, Ellis was cannonballing into the water. 3 years later, in July 2019, Raddick looked considerably more chastened when the newly elected Ellis and the rest of the commissioner's court met to vote on a settlement to the lawsuit, a sweeping $100 million overhaul that largely abolished the practice of jailing misdemeanor defendants who can't afford cash bail. Reformers across the country hailed it as a major step toward making the criminal justice system fundamentally more equitable. The settlement was possible only because, just 8 months before, Harris County voters had handed control of the commissioner's court to Democrats for the first time since 1990. Raddick and Jack Cagle were now the only two Republicans left on the court. Most astonishingly, voters had seen fit to replace Emmett, the beating heart of the county's political establishment for more than a decade, with Lena Hidalgo, a 27-year-old Latina who had moved back to Houston to run against the 69-year-old Emmett. She was the first woman and Latino to lead Harris County. Now, Hidalgo and the other two Democrats, Ellis and former Harris County Sheriff Adrian Garcia, ran things. For years, meetings had rarely lasted an hour. Under the new management, they felt like committee hearings in the state legislature, often going for more than 5 hours, sometimes as long as nine, as the new majority pushed to enact its agenda: criminal justice reform, bringing transparency to county government, and improved flood planning, while members of the public came to support, oppose, and debate. At the July meeting, Hidalgo beamed as she introduced a bail reform settlement to the court. "This is a proud beginning," she said, "in the fight to build a criminal justice system in which fairness and justice are preeminent." She quoted from Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 address on the National Mall. She exuded, as members of her generation would say, good vibes only. Ellis, a political operator who served 27 years in the Texas Senate, spoke glowingly too, calling the settlement somewhat hyperbolically just as big as Brown versus Board of Education. But the most dramatic moment came when he moved closer to his mic and stared at the side of the room where Raddick and Cagle sat. "A very oppressive system has existed for decades," he said, "and I don't point an accusative finger at anyone, but it did, I think, indicate a certain blind indifference to what was going on. I think it's incumbent on us to admit that," he said, slowing for emphasis. When it was his turn to speak, Raddick turned to address the packed chamber, where, during the period of public comments, most had spoken in support of the settlement. He understood that there were racial injustices in the system, he said. But then he began pounding his palms on the wood in front of him. "This is a public table," he said, his voice rising to a shout. "Issues such as bail reform are supposed to be discussed in public, quote, not by a few people from the commissioner's office and whomever behind closed doors, sitting there and discussing what they're going to do for all of us. He stood up, getting angrier, and flipping through the lengthy settlement for the audience. Every single page says, "Draft, confidentially said. I think that sucks." Hidalgo politely noted that the text of the settlement had been made available to the commissioners 3 days earlier. "And let's be careful with the public table," she said. Raddick was learning something Ellis knew very well. "It's not fun to be in a minority in a lawmaking body. There are consequences to elections," Ellis added calmly. At the end of the year, Raddick announced he was retiring, boosting Democrats' chances of electing the fourth Democrat to the commissioner's court this November and giving them the same level of dominance Republicans enjoyed just a few years ago. The Harris County Commissioner's Court has gone from being one of the least surprising places in Texas politics to one of its most interesting. It's partly because the body has enormous responsibilities. 5 million people live in Harris, and 2 million of them live in unincorporated areas where the county is primarily in charge. Its purview ranges from indigent health care to disaster preparedness, from parks to criminal courts. But Harris County government is also a case study, a glimpse of what Texas might look like if Democrats ever win real power. What happens when a place long controlled by one party flips and the outsiders take over? The Democrats on the commissioner's court have spent the past year or so enacting what they say is a progressive agenda and trying to make a clean break from the past, while the Republicans have at times behaved like a stay-behind army in a civil war, using the rules to slow down and obstruct the majority when they can and hoping a backlash will sweep them back into power. Few expected Hidalgo to win. Born in Bogota, Colombia, Hidalgo moved to Houston with her family when she was 15. After graduating from Seven Lakes High School in Katy, she earned a B.A. in political science from Stanford in 2013. She then moved to Thailand to work for an NGO focused on press freedoms before landing in Houston again, where she worked as a Spanish translator for the Texas Medical Center and a volunteer for the Texas Civil Rights Project. Interested in a career in public service, Hidalgo enrolled in a joint public policy and law program at Harvard and New York University. When she left school to run for office in Houston, Hidalgo had never attended a meeting of the commissioner's court in person. She ended up a candidate for such a powerful position precisely because no established Democrat thought a long-shot campaign was worth the trouble, or because they liked Emmett too much to do so, as in the case of former Houston Mayor Anise Parker. In the aftermath of her shock victory, there was widespread skepticism that Hidalgo could handle such a huge job. The doubts were reasonable, given that Hidalgo had little relevant experience, but they also reflected the condescension that 20-something Latinas encounter on the occasions when they step into the halls of power. Since then, Hidalgo has become one of the most visible elected officials in Texas, subject to profiles by national and international publications, a prominent millennial face in American politics, and a closely scrutinized target of political opponents. While being interviewed on local TV news during the Deer Park chemical fire in March 2019, Hidalgo slipped into Spanish at one point, a useful skill given that about a third of the residents of Harris County are native Spanish speakers. But Mark Tice, a commissioner in Chambers County to the east of Harris, condemned her. "Hidalgo was a joke," Tice said. "This is not Mexico," he added. "Speak English." There have been other such moments. "Was it true," I asked Raddick in January, "that he had referred to Hidalgo in hearings as young lady?" "I sure did," said Raddick, who's been serving on a court since 1989, "and she is a young lady. You could say I'm an old man. She's a young lady." It was Hidalgo, he added, who had been insufficiently respectful to him. When Raddick was new to the commissioner's court, he always made sure to show respect to the senior men he served with, something he does not feel the Democrats do. Hidalgo, he says, treats him and other county government veterans with this total know-it-all perspective that she got out of Columbia University. Hidalgo, of course, studied as an undergraduate at Stanford and was born in Columbia. When there was four Republicans and one Democrat, there was no bitterness there at all, Raddick said. Now things are chaotic. He claims that crime is ticking up. It's not, and he's worried about the county's bond rating. Regardless, Hidalgo has been busy. Apart from the bail settlement, the commissioner's court has injected more money into the public defender system while rebuffing District Attorney Kim Ogg's request for a large increase in funding to hire more prosecutors. The Democratic majority is also trying to bolster Harris County's flood planning and strengthen its public transportation network, partly by shifting spending away from wealthier parts of the county to less wealthy ones, and it has undertaken dozens of smaller initiatives, such as the creation of the African American Cultural Heritage Commission. Hidalgo told me she has the most pride in what she regards as her success in throwing open the doors to county government. In a rebuke to the Emmett Court, she sought to establish that we don't need to limit ourselves to sort of a quiet group that meets silently and that deals with technical issues of infrastructure. The way things were done before, she said, were opaque. County departments made budget requests with a one-pager, and hundreds of millions of dollars were dispersed without much thought. For decades, there was no vision for the county, no master plan, no goals, no metrics, she said. From the very start, I've been asking for there to be metrics and goals. Previous courts were just budgeting according to whatever somebody read in the news or whatever they thought was politically expedient, perhaps. Hidalgo is eager to show that the old way of doing business is dead. Sometimes that's been occasion for criticism. When Hidalgo came into office, the county had already spent $2 million in several years preparing to build a new juvenile detention center to replace the county's aging facilities. The Democrats on the court canceled those plans, with Hidalgo criticizing the Emmett Commissioner's Court for tinkering with a complex problem. Instead, she commissioned the Annie E. Casey Foundation, a child welfare advocacy group, and experts from Columbia University to draw up new plans. But the scrapping of the contract means juveniles remain stuck at the current detention centers, which are said to need some $20 million in renovations. Some of the buildings we have now are deplorable, Raddick said. In much the same way, Hidalgo canceled Emmett's proposal to repurpose the abandoned Astrodome as an event center after $8 million had already been spent on restoration. It's been left to the rats. Critics also complained that Hidalgo's public appearances during the Deer Park fire did not inspire confidence. A representative critique on social media charged that she looked like a deer in headlights. At some point, there will be another hurricane, and although Hidalgo has stepped up preparations to deal with such disasters, it's unclear whether she'll perform as well or engender as much goodwill as her predecessor, who served as the reassuring face of recovery for more than a decade. Now in a minority, Raddick and his fellow Republicans have found other ways to show their displeasure. For one, they made a lot of noise. At one meeting regarding transportation funding, Cagle brought copies of George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984 to distribute to the audience, accusing Hidalgo's court of engaging in doublespeak. But the most important scuffle came in October. Commissioners met to pass a tax hike that would increase the county's revenue by 8% before an annual deadline, citing the need to raise money before new laws passed by the state legislature went into effect that would restrict their ability to do so in the future. Cagle and Raddick didn't show up, depriving the court of a quorum and preventing a vote. State law requires that four of the five members of county commissioners' courts be present to vote on tax increases. Hidalgo says the consequences of that missing revenue will hurt the county in the long run. You won't see a huge difference from one year to the next, she said, but it will compound over time. That anti-majoritarian maneuver is one reason why many Republicans in Austin are closely watching what's happening in Harris County. Never huge fans of cities and counties to begin with, GOP lawmakers led by several Houston-area Republicans cracked down hard on local government during the 2019 session. Now imagine if the Democrats tighten their grip on Harris County, finally flip Fort Worth's Tarrant County, the last urban Republican holdout, and take over quickly growing suburban counties like Hayes, south of Austin, and Fort Bend, southwest of Houston. Then they draw new county commissioner precincts to solidify their control. In this dark future for conservatives, Republicans in the legislature work even harder to rein in Hidalgo and her colleagues across the state. If Democrats can pick up Raddick's seat, only one Republican would remain on the commissioner's court, which would prevent that Republican from breaking the quorum again. But what if the legislature, learning from Raddick's example, changed the law to require all five members of the commissioner's court to be present? Many blue counties, even the big Democratic ones like Dallas and Travis, have at least one Republican commissioner who could, if the law were changed, nullify the wishes of the other four and hold one-person veto power over budgetary matters with huge consequences for local governments across the board. That would be a pretty major thing, said Raddick, who's given the issue a good deal of thought, probably one of the most major pieces of legislation to come around in a long time. All of which suggests that Hidalgo may be taking more fire as time goes on. She has pointedly declined to say whether she's running for re-election in 2022, and there are whispers in Houston that other Democrats may start gunning for the seat now that they know it's winnable. There's certainly a lot of policies that I don't know that we can accomplish in 4 years, Hidalgo said, insisting she hasn't thought very much about a next term. But I would hate to talk beyond that. He Hidalgo has a future in politics if she wants it. If she doesn't, perhaps she could return to her graduate studies at Harvard and NYU. The past few years would make for an excellent thesis. We turn now to one of our feature articles. It's the last one in this issue. It's entitled The Legend of John Holmes Jenkins. He was a notorious dealmaker, known for bringing priceless pieces of Texas history back to the state. He was a suspected forger and arsonist, but could he also have masterminded his own death? It's by Chris O'Connell. On the day John Holmes Jenkins died, he was searching for a grave. Finding the final resting place of James B. Burleson, a forgotten figure from early Texas history, would have been a big score for Jenkins. He'd searched plenty of times before because he believed that uncovering the grave could provide a missing piece to a book he'd been writing for years. It would be the first biography of Edward Burleson, a frontier fighter who'd led troops during the earliest conflict of the Texas Revolution, the Siege of Bayard, and the last, the Battle of San Jacinto. Edward was also James's son. Jenkins felt the Burleson legacy had unjustly waned over the course of the 20th century, and what's more, Jenkins' great-grandfather had been raised by Edward. He believed the story was his to tell. Jenkins asked his cousin, a young Episcopal priest named Ken Casellas, to come with him that day and canoe a stretch of the Colorado River about 10 miles north of Bastrop to look for the grave. Casellas had canoed with Jenkins before, and the last time they were on the Colorado, a violent thunderstorm had roared out of the sky, terrifying Casellas. After that, he'd told Jenkins to stop obsessing over the Burleson grave. Even if he managed to locate the site, Casellas insisted, any artifacts would be unsalvageable or, more likely, hidden deep in a thicket, there to remain for all time. Casellas declined to go along. It was Sunday, after all, and he needed to preach. There's nothing out there, Casellas told Jenkins when he called that day. That doesn't matter, Jenkins said. I'm going. It was April 16, 1989, and Jenkins was at something of a personal crossroads. At 49, he had spent much of his professional life as an internationally renowned seller of rare books and Texas artifacts. In the 60s and 70s, when the state's public cathedrals of culture, places like the Kimball Art Museum and the Manil Collection, were still in their infancy, pieces of Texas history were regarded as forms of high art. Jenkins, as much as anyone, had helped create a luxury market for Texana. In 1975, Texas Monthly, itself in its infancy, ran an article about Jenkins for the first time titled, So Rare, Rare Books Are Better Investments Than Most Stock Certificates. The picture accompanying the story showed a young employee of the Jenkins Company next to a stuffed baboon, a Conestoga wagon, and some of the 350,000 books that Jenkins kept in his headquarters, a large yellow building known as The Plant in far south Austin. Jenkinson's business had made millions of dollars along the way, and he often donned the same accoutrements. Gold Rolex, towering Stetson, ostrich skin boots sported by his wealthiest clients. By the late 80s, all of that had fallen apart. Depending on who was telling the story, Jenkins was broke and losing his businesses to the banks, was facing indictment for arson, was in serious debt to Las Vegas casinos, was on the run from mobsters he'd once sent to jail, was a pariah in the world of rare books, or was plagued by some combination of all of the above. But working on the book provided an escape. Long before Jenkins was a flashy dealer of Texana, he dreamed of being an author and a scholar. He published his first book in May 1958, not long after graduating from Beaumont High School as valedictorian, and completing the Burleson book could provide a desperately needed win at a time when his life was a mess. And so, on that April morning, Jenkins dressed and grabbed the keys to his wife's gold Mercedes. He drove 40 miles east from their home in Austin, crossing a wide-open prairie until he arrived in a tiny town called Utley. He turned down a rough farm-to-market road and eventually reached a clearing beneath an underpass, a popular spot for day-trippers known as Humpback Bridge, where a small decline carved in the dirt led to the river. He parked a Mercedes, then he set off for the waters where he'd been so many times before. In the spring of 2017, I traveled to Galveston to tour the Bryan Museum with its founder, J.P. Bryan. Museum's billing as world's largest collection of artifacts relating to Texas and the American West seemed hyperbolic, but the collection did not disappoint. The history of the state unfurls in the halls of the building's opulent interior, appointed with dark woods and marble and brass trims. Brian had spent most of his career in the oil and gas business, but in his later years he made his mark as a preservationist and is now focused on his earliest hobby, collecting Texana. He stocked the museum, which opened in 2015, with items from his personal collection. Near the end of the tour, I asked him if there was one specific artifact that had eluded him in his five decades of collecting. And he pointed to a poster of the Texas Declaration of Independence, a version similar to something you might see hanging on the walls of a seventh grade classroom. I wish I had a real one, but I don't, Brian added, adding that he had once spent $25,000 on a declaration that he thought was authentic. I didn't find out until maybe 5 years after I bought it, but it was fake. Who could fabricate, much less sell, a faked Texas Declaration of Independence, I asked him. My old business partner, Brian said. His name was John Jenkins. Brian had met Jenkins in the 60s at the University of Texas at Austin. Both were studying law, and both were already somewhat established collectors. Brian had purchased his first piece of Texana, an old Sharps pistol, when he was a boy. Jenkins was splitting time between law classes and a rare coin business that he ran with his wife Maureen out of a storefront in downtown Austin, just blocks from the Capitol. Brian soon joined them as a partner. He invested in the coin business and helped start a rare books trade in the shop. At first they made money and expanded by opening their own press to publish out-of-print titles they felt were noteworthy, such as the first cookbook written in Texas and an early biography of J. Frank Dobie. Jenkins used the imprint for his own writing, too, often focusing on obscure Texas characters whose stories had gone untold. He published, for example, a short biography of Monroe Edwards, a once infamous slave trader who'd made a fortune by forging documents before disappearing from the state. Eventually, their partnership came to an end. Brian split with Jenkins shortly before graduating from law school. By the end, we'd become a little bit, I don't want to say adversarial, but competitive with one another, Brian said. He'd always find some way to surprise me, to get something for his own that I rightly thought we should have shared. There was some tension, but I thought that's the price of admission with John Jenkins. I left the museum wanting to know more about Jenkins, and it didn't take long to learn the story of his death. A fisherman had found Jenkins' body partly submerged in the Colorado, across from the boat ramp where he had parked the gold Mercedes. He'd been shot in the back of the head. His wallet was found in the dirt nearby, nearly empty. The Mercedes was still there, but the keys were gone. Investigators didn't find a gun at the scene or much evidence at all that could indicate what happened. The Bastrop County Sheriff called the death a suicide. The Justice of the Peace ruled homicide. In October 1989, 6 months after Jenkins' death, the New Yorker published an article by Calvin Trillin about Jenkins' life as a Texana dealer. His death was front-page news, Trillin wrote, not only because of the violent circumstances, but also because he had often been on the front page when he was alive. But the article didn't offer a definitive account of what happened on that day. Both in Austin and Bastrop County, Trillin wrote, there's a feeling that there may never be much more known about what happened to John Jenkins at the boat ramp that Sunday. Trillin ended the article with a quote from one of Jenkins' childhood friends, who believed that whatever happened, Jenkins had almost certainly orchestrated some surprise to come, some message to deliver from the afterlife. I like to think he developed a great story with a kicker, the quote read. He wrote a novel or a movie script, and he sent it to someone in Kathmandu, and he said, in a year, send this to my wife, and the proceeds are to go to my estate, and I'm to get proper credit. If it doesn't have that part, it's not Jenkins. 30 years later, no one can agree on what really happened to Jenkins. People who know his story, or those who know him personally, hypothesize and argue about what clues he may have left behind. What was the kicker? What was the part that made it Jenkins? I found people on both ends of the spectrum, from family members who insisted that Jenkins was murdered, to old associates and friends who swear he died by suicide. Regardless of what people believed, though, they all had a story to tell. Here's where the story begins. After his split with Brian, Jenkins left school and started making bigger plans. He sold his remaining coins and purchased a large yellow building in far south Austin to house his growing inventory of Texana, which by 1970 had become his focus. He spent much of that year traveling to auctions, and scored a huge portion of the remaining inventory of the Washington, D.C. bookseller Loudermilk's, the same store that Larry McMurtry used to start his own shop, Booked Up, which he would famously move from D.C. to his hometown of Archer City some years later. At the time, there was a renewed interest in collecting Texana. Children of the 50s, having grown up watching shows like Walt Disney's Davy Crockett, now had money to spend, thanks largely to the post-World War II boom. At the same time, wealthy oil men were leaving the oil patch and moving into high-rises in Houston and Dallas, and in a few cases, the chambers at the state capitol. Nothing completed an office setting better than a musket from the Alamo or a bookshelf full of first editions by Dobie or Webb. It was a wild time, the late screenwriter and Texana buff Bill Whitliff told me, not long before he died, last summer. Johnny was one of the players, and he knew a world about rare books. Jenkins was set on being more than a player in the industry. He wanted to be the industry. In those early years of his business, he called his company simply the Jenkins Company. He spent most nights at his big yellow warehouse or his office at home, working to catalog his stock or scheming a way to pay off the banknotes that were financing his collection. What he couldn't sell to customers, he wanted to trade with his friends, and plenty of those deals were hatched at the card table during the marathon poker sessions that Jenkins hosted, where he'd sit cross-legged in his chair, puffing away on a Cuban cigar. In another Texas Monthly article about Jenkins and those devil-may-care days of selling and collecting Texana, the magazine's then-editor-in-chief, Gregory Curtis, wrote, "In one trade that took 2 days of constant negotiation, Jenkins got a Rolls-Royce, a Kentucky rifle, and a Bowie knife. Price Daniel Jr., the son of the former governor and a book dealer before he became a politician, got a book collection. The car dealer who had owned the Rolls got an antique racing car. A restaurant owner got several thousand Cuban cigars. And Texana dealer Dorman David got a $20,000 credit at legendary restaurant Maxim's in Houston, which he traded for some rare wines, which he in turn traded to Jenkins for books and documents. What fun!" Trillin, in his New Yorker article, put it this way. "In Texas, which has an honored pioneer tradition of haggling and bartering, trading among people who dealt in books and antiques evolved during the 60s into a phenomenon that nearly qualified as a spectator sport. At the center of this game was Dorman David. David, one of the most notorious dealers in the state, was the type of obscure, soon-to-be-infamous character who excited Jenkins. He had family oil money to spend and a well-known shop in Houston called the Bookman." Break in briefly here and remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Radio. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, or streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Broadcasting since 1967. And now back to our text. His drug habits and stints in jail and string of marriages and divorces were well documented but rarely overshadowed by the priceless items that passed through his shop. "One time I took a mummy to Waco," he told Trillin. "It was in a coffin, a sarcophagus of carved wood. That was a big trade." After Jenkins split from Brian, David became his running buddy. McMurtry, whose book collecting, selling, and trading predated his book writing, frequented David's store. After David eventually went broke, McMurtry took over the Bookman for a short time, and David's mother, Grace, became McMurtry's inspiration for Aurora Greenway in Terms of Endearment. McMurtry viewed Jenkins as the better collector and trader. Some of Jenkins's best pieces came from David's stock, but what David lacked in skill or knowledge, he compensated with his flash. Learning those traits from David, McMurtry believed, was the real turning point in Jenkins's career. Both men were mavericks, consciously and proudly so, a two-man herd, conducting a kind of top-speed stampede through the trade, kicking up as much dust as they possibly can as they ran. McMurtry wrote that in 1991. "Each strove with all his might to become a legend in his own time, and both succeeded. They didn't work like crazy to become legends in their own time, hoping not to be talked about." One day during the summer of 1971, a man calling himself Carl Hoffman visited the Jenkins warehouse in Austin to make a deal. Hoffman, who'd flown in from New York, was looking to move an early manuscript of the Koran, and a set of engraving plates that featured intricate sketches by the famed naturalist John Audubon. The two chatted briefly about prices and provenance, and then Hoffman told Jenkins he'd call him in about a week. What followed, in Jenkins' telling at least, sounds like the script for a television detective series. Jenkins, in fact, would later try to get his version adapted for an episode of Kojak. Jenkins claimed he saw a notice in a bookseller's trade publication alerting subscribers that a Koran and some Audubon plates had been stolen from Union College, a small liberal arts school in upstate New York. Jenkins called the FBI and, after some convincing, arranged a sting operation to catch the thieves. Flew to New York and met with Hoffman and his associates at a seedy motel in Queens, where he saw the merchandise and spent several hours negotiating a deal. At one point, Jenkins realized that Hoffman had a gun. A big one, Jenkins wrote, more like the one John Wayne wears on his hip. Jenkins was spooked, but he talked his way out of the situation by agreeing to meet the high price that Hoffman was demanding, but he needed more time to get together that amount of cash. He left and alerted the waiting FBI agents. Jenkins then returned without the money, and just as he saw Hoffman reaching for his gun, the agents busted in, pistols drawn, and arrested the bad guys. According to Jenkins, the agents told him that Hoffman was a New York mobster. Jenkins was lucky to be alive. The details of the story are hard to confirm, but the publicity for Jenkins that followed was most certainly real. Union College offered him a $2,000 reward, which he refused, insisting that the school use the money to fund a prize in his name that would be awarded to a student who compiled the best bibliography that accompanied a research project. The John H. Jenkins Award was presented annually at Union until 2018. When Jenkins returned to Austin, a group of reporters met him at the airport and wrote glowing articles about the Audubon caper. Up until his death, most people familiar with Jenkins knew him as the man who once foiled the mob and saved some invaluable pieces of history. Jenkins's business increased immensely over the next 4 years, partly because of his newfound fame. And by 1975, the Jenkins Company was reportedly doing $1 million a year in sales. But he was feeling restless. Jenkins began courting the wealthy Eberstadt family in New Jersey. The family patriarch, Edward, whose collection was rumored to include close to 40,000 rare books and documents, had died in 1958, and for nearly 15 years the Eberstadt collection, as it was known, existed only as a rumor to the hordes of booksellers dying to buy a piece. For a while, Jenkins was rebuffed. Edwards's heirs didn't want to sell, but Jenkins' persistence paid off, and in August 1975, he completed what is still considered one of the biggest deals in rare books history. There were, along with the large cache of Texana and Western history, handwritten jokes from Abraham Lincoln and an early printing of the Emancipation Proclamation. There were contemporaneous diaries from George Armstrong Custer's Indian Wars. There were letters and journals that detail almost every American military campaign of the 19th century. In 13 years of active collecting and trading, Jenkins wrote, I had handled perhaps 200 such books. Now he had 40,000. Jenkins finalized the purchase in a room at the Eberstadt Estate in New Jersey with 20 people, bankers, accountants, lawyers, members of the Eberstadt family, and at least one Austin police officer present. Moving the hundreds of crates that contained the collection from the Eberstadt vault into Jenkins' truck took nearly 40 hours. It's hard to overstate the importance of the acquisition. The collection included unpublished documents that had been signed by the Big Four of the Republic of Texas, Sam Houston, William Travis, David Burnett, and Stephen F. Austin. There were sketches that outlined the plans of Father Antonio Margil to create some of the earliest Spanish missions in Texas. Jenkins found land deeds and censuses from the original Texas counties. There was a copy of sheet music from 1836 for the Texan Grand March, the cover of which contained a lithograph of Stephen F. Austin receiving a sword from Santa Anna. Most importantly, according to Jenkins, the Eberstadt collection contained the petition that Austin wrote to Santa Anna on October 2, 1833, which declared the need for a separate statehood for Texas and resulted in Austin's arrest and jailing for nearly 2 years. In some ways, the history of Texas was rewritten by the materials that Jenkins unearthed. You could do a paper, maybe even a book, on the major items in the collection, says Don Carlton, the executive director of the Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas at Austin. Soon after the acquisition, University of Texas spent $1.4 million to purchase a sizable chunk of the Eberstadt from Jenkins. A headline in the university's alumni magazine declared, "Yale eclipsed by UT," and the article noted that the Eberstadt purchase positioned Texas among the best historical research centers in the world. The sale made the front page of the now-defunct Dallas Times-Herald and was covered by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and according to Jenkins, an Associated Press wire story ran in virtually every paper in the world. Jenkins claimed that he was besieged by librarians everywhere, from Yale to Huntington, from Japan to Australia to England and Germany. The Antiquarian Bookman, the leading trade publication for book dealers, said the trade was fortunate for the world of scholarship. The pieces from the Eberstadt collection had extended far beyond Texas, and Jenkins wasn't shy about predicting the far-reaching effects of his score. According to the New Yorker, Jenkins had bragged that while cultural life in America was long centered in the East, Philadelphia in the 18th century, Boston and New York in the 19th and 20th, he had shifted the epicenter to Texas heading into the 21st. In 1980, his peers elected him president of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, a position that cemented his legacy. Jenkins was a star, the most high-profile man in the industry. In September 2017, I visited Maureen Jenkins at her Austin condo. The floors in her living room were covered with boxes of newspaper clippings, manuscripts, and sepia-tone photographs. Maureen was packing a few crates to send to the DeGolyer Library at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, where a small collection of Jenkins' papers is housed. Most of the photos showed the high-flying days of Jenkins' careers. Others, however, told the sadder story of when Jenkins' warehouses started catching on fire. In one picture, taken in the fall of 1987, rows of smoke-blackened books tower above a pile of fire-licked pages strewn about on the floor of a warehouse. A metal facade bearing the words Jenkins Publishing Company is pictured in another photo, except the O and the M have been nearly destroyed by the firefighters cutting through the building to create their own entrance. The first major fire occurred at the plant on Christmas Eve of 1985, and Jenkins claimed that nearly 500,000 books and documents were destroyed. Investigators ruled the fire an accident, and Jenkins received more than $2 million as an insurance settlement. Despite the investigators' ruling, many of those who knew Jenkins best were skeptical that the fire was an accident. To understand why, it's important to know what had changed in the Texana trade by the mid-80s. The oil bust had ravaged the state's economy and bankrupted some of Jenkins' best customers. Quickly selling large chunks of the Eberstadt collection had been crucial for Jenkins to stay above water. He claimed the loans that financed the deal were costing him $700 a day in interest, but the savings and loan crisis had cut off his clients' access to easy credit. As the Texana market cooled, Jenkins' interest in running a Texana dealing business seemed to cool as well. The fame that had accompanied the Eberstadt deal had spread him thin. Jenkins was spending more time traveling across the globe on guest lecture circuit than traveling to the backroom book auctions that he'd used to build his business in the first place. In 1980, Jenkins had hired a young Austin librarian named Kevin MacDonald to oversee the company's massive literature department. MacDonald told me that Jenkins' revenue had tapered off significantly during the first couple of years that he worked there. But the bigger drain on Jenkins' finances was happening in Las Vegas, where, MacDonald says, Jenkins was spending what seemed like half the year. The stakes of Jenkins' poker games in Austin were always high, but he never got the kind of action he found inside poker rooms in Vegas. Legendary gambler Amarillo Slim even gave him a nickname, Austin Squatty. In bluffing Texas style, the arsons, forgeries, and high-stakes poker capers of rare book dealer Johnny Jenkins, which will be published this month by the University of Oklahoma Press, Santa Fe rare books dealer and one-time Jenkins acquaintance Michael Vinson writes that Jenkins had started using cash from book deals, profitable or not, to finance week-long trips to Vegas. When his own cash ran out, he opened lines of credit with casinos all over town. By the mid-80s, he reportedly owed money to 20 different poker rooms, and according to a source who spoke with Vinson, His Vegas debt had topped $1 million. Back at the plant, McDonald started to become alarmed over a huge deal between Jenkins and a wealthy Midland oilman and rancher named L.R. French. French was something of a godsend. He was an obsessive collector with deep pockets who wasn't slowing down at the first signs of a bust. For a couple of years, French's big purchases nearly offset the losses Jenkins was suffering elsewhere. French stored much of his collection in a vault at the plant. Jenkins had promised that each time he obtained a different copy of a book or document in better condition than the one French had purchased, he'd swap it out to make French's collection more valuable. But, McDonald says, he eventually learned Jenkins went the other way, replacing French's books with battered copies and, in some instances, outright forgeries or cheap facsimiles. A lot of people want to romanticize Jenkins like he's a scamp, like there's something cute or funny about it, says McDonald, who left the company around this time to start his own rare books business. But when people steal or forge Texas documents, they're messing with history. They're corrupting the historical record. There's nothing funny about that. French realized something was off, and in 1987 he asked McDonald and another Austin-area dealer, Tom Taylor, to review some suspicious pieces in his collection. They did, and broke the news that he'd been duped. I'm sitting there thinking, this is the kind of stuff where people kill each other, McDonald remembers. Taylor, it turned out, had launched his own investigation into the alarming number of forged documents, such as the Texas Declaration of Independence or William Travis's Victory or Death Letter from the Alamo, that were appearing all over the Texana market in the 70s and 80s. Taylor had inadvertently purchased and sold one himself, and as he told Trillin for the New Yorker article, every time I walked into a library, another forgery seemed to pop up. He spent months compiling a list of suspicious documents. He found them in some of the best-known libraries in the state, and even one that had been purchased by Governor Bill Clements. He tracked down nearly 60 high-end forged documents that he was able to trace back to their origin, and as he later wrote in his 1991 book, Tex Fake, an account of the theft and forgery of early Texas printed documents. He found that more than half had come from the Jenkins Company, including at least 7 copies of the Travis letter and 6 copies of the Declaration of Independence. Dorman David, Jenkins's old running buddy who by the mid-80s had gone broke and was out of the business, spoke with Taylor at length about the forgeries. He confessed to making plates that were used to produce forged documents. He did so, he claimed, in the name of art. He also claimed that Jenkins eventually acquired the remaining forgeries after part of the Bookman was liquidated. Johnny certainly knew what he was doing, Taylor told me. There's no doubt in my mind about that. In the summer of 1987, French sent a truckload of expensive Texana to the plant. McDonald remembers French telling Jenkins that he still had some of the forgeries and would present them as evidence if he had to alert the authorities, which he planned to do if he was not repaid in full. Jenkins had lost his whale. 2 months later, South Austin warehouse went up in flames. Authorities, no doubt noting that this was the second fire at a Jenkins establishment in less than 2 years, suspected arson early on. Travis County District Attorney's Office already had a file on Jenkins. It was compiling evidence on the suspected forgeries, and the file was sent to Joey Porter, an investigator in the office of the state fire marshal. He eventually filed a 7-page report describing the building and the damage that the fire had caused. The final page details Porter's examination of the mail room where most of the damage occurred and where the fire started. The examination of the fire origin provided no evidence or indication of natural or accidental fire causes, he wrote. This fact, coupled with the presence of flammable liquids, resulted in a determination that this fire was of incendiary origin. In other words, someone started the blaze with the intent to damage the building. On March 30, 1988, Dale Trimble, an attorney for the Houston firm Fulbright & Jaworski, deposed Jenkins regarding his insurance claim on the fire. Trimble's firm represented the underwriters. In the testimony, Trimble states, "This fire was investigated and was found by the state's fire marshal to have been intentionally set." Jenkins replies, That is my understanding. I mean, it seems like just a matter of minutes from the time you left the building until the time the fire was reported, Trimble says.
Yes.
That was the same way with the fire back in December of 1985, wasn't it? Trimble asks.
Not quite the same, but similar, yes, Jenkins responds.
And you were the last person in the building on that day, too.
Yes, Jenkins says, I was.
When Jenkins died, his wallet was reportedly empty except for his Social Security card, but that isn't entirely true. There was another card in Jenkins' wallet, a business card of Joey Porter, who had given it to Jenkins while investigating the 1987 fire. He considered Porter enemy number one, McDonald says. Porter was the guy dogging Jenkins. Porter interpreted the business card and the wallet to be a F.U. Joey Porter.
That was weird, Porter told me when I asked him why Jenkins might have left the card in his wallet, because I'd only talked to him one time, but we were getting close to taking a case to a grand jury.
J.P. Bryan, Jenkins' old partner, was giving Jenkins legal advice around the time of the fire. He was prepared to represent Jenkins should the arson investigation be turned over to the FBI, which he feared would happen. I can assure you that Jenkins knew he was about to be indicted by the fire marshal for arson, Bryan said. Porter, after speaking with a variety of anonymous informants, wrote another memorandum noting a likely motive for Jenkins to commit arson. He wasn't meeting his payroll or making various loan payments due presumably to his debts. The memo also details that a judgment of approximately $300,000 was levied against Jenkins by the FDIC, stemming from an old drilling rig investment he had made, and an Austin bank was set to foreclose on the plant. We came up with a figure of outstanding indebtedness from what you have given us of $2,177,465.40, Trimble told Jenkins during his deposition, give or take a dime. In the weeks leading up to his death, Jenkins knew he'd be at the center of the forged documents scandal if the news went public. He knew he was about to be indicted for arson, and he knew he was deeper in debt than he could ever repay. In April 1989, a few hours after Jenkins had left home for the Colorado River, Maureen learned that her husband had been found dead. Ken Casellas later relayed the story he'd heard from the Bastrop County coroner. A man named Robert Donnell was driving through the county on the same Farnham Market Road that Jenkins took to the river, saw the gold Mercedes parked under the humpback bridge, and drove down to the car. Driver's side door was open. One of the rear tires was flat. A wallet was on the ground next to it. Donnell turned around and drove to the sheriff's office, and by the time deputies made it to the bridge, a group of fishermen had pulled Jenkins' body out of the water. According to the autopsy report, the gunshot wound was a contact type, meaning the barrel of the gun was pressed directly against the spot where the bullet entered. Bullet had passed through the skull at an upward angle. Jenkins didn't have any powder burns or residue on his hands. The Lower Colorado River Authority partially dammed the river to lower its level, and the county borrowed a huge magnet from nearby Bergstrom Air Force Base to drag the bottom. Investigators pulled up the keys to Maureen's Mercedes, but no weapon was found. Two Bastrop County agencies ruled on a death. The county's Justice of the Peace, Bill Henderson, who was responsible for signing a death certificate, ruled it a homicide, but Sheriff Con Kiersey called it a suicide. April 26, a week after Jenkins was found, Austin American Statesman published an article with quotes from both men. Kiersey, who investigated homicides for decades with the Austin Police Department before becoming Bastrop Sheriff, said the angle was completely compatible with suicide. I don't think Henderson studied the facts. It's measurable. It's physics. Henderson told the paper he believed Jenkins was murdered because of those same physics. I'm not convinced, he said, that the path of the bullet could have been done by Jenkins himself. Maureen never pursued a private investigation. I just didn't think about hiring an investigator, she said, adding that she was in a fog following her husband's death. Her sister and her sister's two children moved in with her shortly after, and Maureen stayed busy trying to salvage what was left of the Jenkins company. She believes that Jenkins' habit of carrying a large wad of cash got him killed. I feel like somebody shot him and took the money. That was that. That's it, Maureen told me. For the most part, the case is cold. According to a spokesperson with the Bastrop County Sheriff's Office, all the documents relating to the sheriff's investigation were discarded years ago, in line with the office's policy on record-keeping. When I talked to Kiersey 2 years ago, he remembered the Jenkins case well. He recalled turning up black marks against Jenkins easily enough. He had no doubt that Jenkins had killed himself.
Henderson, Bastrop's Justice of the Peace, died in 1993, but that office still has a small case file on Jenkins' death. One of the documents is a letter from former Senator, U.S. Senator Ralph Yarbrough, in which he praises Henderson's homicide ruling. Yarbrough had settled in Austin after leaving the Senate in 71, was a longtime friend of Jenkins's. He was in debt, yes, but if everyone in debt committed suicide, you'd have to open up some new cemeteries, wrote Yarbrough, who recalled how excited Jenkins was about his Burleson book. I do not believe for one minute that John Jenkins would take his own life, as a noted historian, just as he was about to publish the best work of his lifetime. I called back J.B. Bryan to ask him what he thought happened that day at the river. I believe it was a suicide, he told me. I'm not saying that because I didn't love Johnny, but I could see what Johnny had done. And he told me a story. At a poker game around 1984-85, Bryant can't remember for sure there were so many poker games back then, the talk around the table turned to money and schemes. Jenkins stood up and declared he concocted the final get-rich scheme. Get an insurance policy, a boat, and a gun. You find a quiet body of water, he explained. You tie the gun to a balloon, stand up in the back of the boat, and shoot yourself in the back of the head. Your body falls off the boat, and the weapon floats away in the current so the cops never find it. They'll have to say it's a murder, and your family collects the insurance money. He pops up and says this. I can tell you how you can commit the perfect suicide, Bryan says. When Jenkins died, Bryan immediately remembered that story. In fact, he remembered Jenkins telling it more than once. I thought it was in some ways prophetic, so to speak, Bryan says. The whole circumstance. The Colorado River, right by where his great-grandfather had settled, right near the location of the setting of the book he was writing. That was a statement. I've come to where my roots are. This is where my life is going to end. The palatial Galveston Museum that Bryan founded is far grander than anything Jenkins ever built. The plant still stands in South Austin. It's now an adult video megaplex. Outside the Bryan, fountains drip on the meticulous green lawn, which is dotted with palm trees that shade the old building. It was once an orphanage and stands in one of the few structures that survived the 1900 hurricane. When you think of all the treasures inside that tell the story of Texas, from Santa Ana's sword to an impossibly rare copy of Cabeza de Vaca's 1542 Alacion, it's easy to think that Jenkins would have loved the place. As Bryan walked me through the museum on the first day we met, he talked about Jenkins selling him the fake Texas Declaration of Independence. He told me Jenkins had called him out of the blue, offering a declaration. Bryan was thrilled not only to have what he thought was one of the few copies of the Declaration, but to buy it from his friend. I loved Johnny, Bryan told me. I was aware there were fake documents on the market, and you had to be careful. I should have known better, but it wasn't like I was suspicious of Johnny. I thought it was the real thing. Bryan has one regret, though. He trashed a declaration he had bought when he found out it was fake. Authentic or not, he said, it was an authentic John Jenkins. The story around it was so unbelievable, Bryan says, I'd give anything to have it back. This past fall, I met Ken Casellas at his church in downtown Bastrop. He'd once served as a minister here, but he retired several years ago. He wanted to tell me about the Burleson book Jenkins was trying to finish before he died. He told me that Jenkins had started collecting documents relating to Burleson when Jenkins was a teenager, and during his time at the University of Texas, he hunted through the school's archives to amass a gigantic file on Burleson. The documents and pictures traveled with him from office to office, from home to home. After Jenkins died, Maureen gave the file to Casellas. He finished the book and published it himself in 1990 through the old Jenkins Company imprint. Today, Edward Burleson, Texas frontier leader, is difficult to find. Copies are available through online sellers for hundreds of dollars, but the Briscoe Center, where pieces of the Eberstadt collection are housed, keeps a library-only copy on hand. According to Casellas' introduction, Jenkins' obsession with Burleson would wax and wane over the years, but it crested again a few years before his death, when, for the Texas sesquicentennial, a group of historians named the 25 most important figures in Texas history. Burleson was left off the list. It was largely the realization of this neglect, Casellas writes, that initially led John Jenkins to determine that he would, by finishing a biography of Edward Burleson, finally revive a proper memory of him. Unfortunately, it's tough to determine what a proper memory of Jenkins would look like. Would it call to mind the impassioned student of Texas history who wanted to be known as a first-rate researcher and author? The savvy collector and seller of genuine Texana? The swindler, whose marks, some of them at least, still regarded him with reluctant affection? Or the desperate man who'd been accused of torching his life's work and perhaps put a bullet through his head to escape the financial trap he had, through years of recklessness, set for himself? In a final indignity, Union College's Alumni Magazine ran a story 9 years ago that suggested that Jenkins' heroic actions in the 1971 recovery of the stolen Koran and Audubon engravings may not have been what they appeared to be. At least one of the men involved in the scam stated that Jenkins was in on the theft from the start, though this is difficult to square with the information we have about the case. Inevitably, any proper memory of Jenkins will encompass all of these facets, which is why we can glimpse Jenkins in full, that final mystery accepted, only if we give weight to all of the places where he lives on, in Casellas' Burleson book, in Vincent's new biography, in the remains of the Eberstadt collection, in the minds of the handful of Texans who will tell stories about him to anyone who will listen, and in the $1,000 fellowship in his name that the Texas State Historical Association has awarded every year since 1995. Longtime members of the Texana community, McDonald and Taylor included, reserve a special kind of outrage for the John H. Jenkins Research Fellowship in Texas History. Casellas won't hear any of it. His dedication in the Burleson biography is one sentence long. It reads simply, "This is John's book." And that, conveniently enough, brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2, on Sight in the Sound Broadcasting, your print information source.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by audiobook news at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Supreme Court suspends eviction action. The Supreme Court of Texas has issued an emergency order in connection with the coronavirus state of disaster. No action can be taken until April 19 regarding evictions, according to a press release from the city spokeswoman. These actions include trial, hearing, or other proceeding or serving with a lawsuit for eviction.
I stay out late at night and play my songs. And sometimes all the nights can be so long. And it's good when I finally make it home all alone while she lays dreaming. I try to get undressed without the light, and quietly she says, "How was your night?" And I come to her and say, "It was all right," and I hold her tight, and she believes in me. Told her someday if she was my girl, I could change the world with my little songs. I was wrong, but she has faith in me, and so I go on trying faithfully. And who knows, maybe on some special night, if my song is right, I will find a way, while she lays waiting. I stumble to the kitchen for a bite. Then I see my old guitar in the night, just waiting for me like a secret friend, and there's no end while she lays crying. I fumble with a melody or two, then I'm torn between the things that I should do. Then she says to wake her up when I am through,
God, her love is true.
And she believes in me. I told her someday, if she was my girl, I could change the world with my little songs. I was wrong, but she has faith in me, and so I go on trying faithfully. And who knows, maybe on some special night, my song is right, I will find a way. While she lays, while she waits for me.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 62 and partly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts, and I will be reading the Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From the Houston Chronicle, In the Garden by Kathy Huber. Growing limes? Here are three good choices. Question: could you please recommend a hardy, tasty lime tree for Houston? I would use it for baking and for drinks. I've had very good luck growing a Meyer lemon on my upper deck, and that's where I would plant the lime. Jean Winkleman, Houston. Answer: growing a lime in a container on your deck will enable you to move it to a sheltered spot during a freeze. The lime is more cold tender than the lemon. Sun and a fertile, well-draining soil will encourage a healthy, productive plant. You'll find limes at various Master Gardener fruit tree sales this time of year, and several nurseries now stock citrus. Limes grown in our area include the thornless Mexican lime, key lime, excellent in containers, is a prolific bearer of small, juicy, aromatic, thin-skinned fruit. It produces flowers and fruits almost continuously. The compact plant needs lots of light and good air circulation and drainage. The Persian lime is a seedless, nearly thornless cultivar with larger, slightly less acidic fruit with long storage on the tree as well as on the shell. The nearly seedless Palestinian sweet lime is for those who prefer low-acid fruit. Question: I planted four Gulf muley grasses in early spring 3 years ago and have had very few seed heads produced. After the first year, I cut back the blades to about 4 inches in the spring. Last year I didn't trim. The plants are on the north side of the garden, in a garden area receiving afternoon sun, and get the same amount of watering as the surrounding flowers and shrubs. Any thoughts on what I can get to do to get them to produce the feathery stalks next fall? Do you recommend trimming the blades? Cindy Bartos, Houston. Answer: yes, I recommend trimming the grasses late winter, early spring, before new growth begins. I trim mine back pretty close to the ground each year, typically late January into February. I've found this encourages robust new growth and more bloom stalks, especially if the plants are growing in abundant sun and soil with great drainage. Check the number of hours of direct sun your plant gets. Sometimes a northern exposure is not as sunny as others. I water to established newly planted ornamental grasses, then back way off the watering once the plants are fairly mature, so make sure you're not overwatering. Gulf muley, like other grasses in this genus, are among the most heat and drought tolerant pest-free perennials available. tough enough for life in a median, the native is foolproof in the home garden. Now is a good time to plant. In early fall, the flower stalks begin to shoot up through the 3-foot clumps of narrow blue-green foliage, doubling the overall size of the plants. The purplish haze of blooms lasts for weeks, a grand sight in early morning and late afternoon rays. When the delicate flowers go to seed, I'll leave the grasses as dried arrangements in the winter garden. In early February, I'll pull on gloves and cut the clumps as close to the ground as possible so the old foliage won't distract from the new come spring. The gloves prevent the dried grass blades from slicing my hands. Question. I have a 20-year-old tangerine tree that is struggling. It was grown from a seed in my compost and has only been producing for 3 years, and last year it had its largest crop. However, within 2 weeks, contractors burying a broadband box about 2 feet from my tangerine, the tree lost all its leaves and I thought it was dead. Then, after lots of rain, leaves started coming back and I thought it was recovering. 2 large branches extend from a fork about 4 feet up from the trunk. One branch is dead. The other is alive but not healthy. The tangerine crop was about a third of what it was in past years, and fruit is less than half the normal size. I'd like to save the tree if possible. What can I do to keep it alive? Kathy Widner, Houston. Answer. It sounds like the roots were cut when they dropped the box into the ground. I appreciate your sentimental attachment to the tangerine and your years of patience waiting on the first fruit from a seed-grown tree. Since half your tree is dead and the other half is struggling, it will take a lot more to try to save it. I would spread compost beneath the canopy, scratching it into the soil if possible. You can try fertilizing with nitrogen this month. Follow application instructions on the package, usually a certain number of cups per trunk size. Keep the soil moist but not soggy. Good drainage is essential. Given our overall mild winter, perhaps you've already spotted more new growth. No promises, but I hope the tree will regrow and eventually regain a fuller shape. If not, a new tree may be in your future. I would recommend a grafted tree versus a seed-grown tree, as it will take just a few years to produce fruit. Question. An ugly brown fungus is eating up my yard. Do you know what it is? What can I do about it? A homeowner, Houston. Answer. Those are mushrooms in your emailed photo. They are feeding on decomposing organic matter in your lawn. This happens in our landscape from time to time, and I look on it as a good sign there is organic matter present. The mushrooms are harmless, and I would just let them disappear on their own. However, while some mushrooms are edible, never eat any unless identified by an expert. Keep an eye on children and pets so they won't be tempted. Question. When and how hard can I prune a Texas sage? I have the tall ruellias with the purple flowers in late summer. If I prune them, will they become bushy and bloom more? Dave Sharon, Houston. Answer. Prune Texas sage in late winter, early spring, after the threat of any freezing temps. Prune a third, angling your cuts to encourage sunlight to penetrate the shrub to promote bushier growth in the center of the plant and closer to the ground. You can trim to shape later in the growing season if you wish. I severely cut back leggy ruellias. This helps tidy up their appearance and makes way for fresh new growth. But since ruellias wander as well as reseed, I think the best show comes when the perennials have been corralled into a large, close-growing clump, providing a big bouquet of the purple blooms. From the Houston Chronicle. Sustainability Grows in the Garden by Dean Fosdick. Small-scale, eco-friendly practices can have a big impact. Sustainable is one of the gardening trend's buzzwords, yet it carries a range of definitions. Just what does it mean in practical terms, and how important is it to the average gardener? Very important, according to a recent plant trends study by horticulturists with the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It found strong interest in native plants, rewilding gardens, growing edibles, and going easy on wildlife, among other concerns. more and more people are supporting sustainability where the social, environmental, and economic factors balance, said Mark Tansig, a horticultural agent with University of Florida Food and Agricultural Sciences Extension. That doesn't mean planting things that don't require as much water or fertilizer, using plants that resist disease and insects, choosing native